Hey everyone, and welcome to this special feature edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This edition of the show was made possible thanks to the support of the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative. They gave us some funding to produce these podcasts, and they're really designed to educate policymakers and the wider community on cybersecurity issues. And we have a very special guest today, Rob Joyce. These days, Rob leads the Cybersecurity Directorate at NSA, a role previously held by the current Deputy National Security Advisor, Anne Neuberger. As many listeners would know, Rob has a pretty interesting resume, having served as a special advisor on cybersecurity to US President Donald Trump, and before that, he led tailored access operations for NSA. More recently, he served as the NSA liaison to Britain's GCHQ, but he returned to the USA this year to take up his new post as the head of NSA's defense-oriented cybersecurity directorate. And here's the thing. Rob is a senior bureaucrat who is actually genuinely passionate about technology. He even does con talks, really good con talks. He did one on how to make TAO's life hard many years ago. That was really a great technical talk. Indeed, Adam Boileau's colleague Mark Piper did more or less his own version of that talk on how to make a red teamer's life miserable. I've seen that talk and that was great. He's even done a DEF CON talk about how to do over-the-top, you know, computer-controlled Christmas light displays. His Christmas lights are so crazy, they actually made the news, okay? And I'm telling you this to let you know that Rob is, you know, he's a real, actual security geek. He's the hacker bureaucrat, if you will. Anyway, he generously made himself available to do this interview with me, and we cover a bunch of stuff. The terrible state of enterprise security, cloud service providers being dumb with their defaults, the role of the intelligence community in combating ransomware, and more. But we had to start off with some nuts and bolts discussion about what NSA's Cybersecurity Directorate actually does, because, yeah, for a lot of people, they're like, well, hang on, aren't they just like a different version of Caesar? But no. So here's Rob on that, and then, yeah, there's some quality banter. I hope you enjoy it.
So, Patrick, first, it's great to be here. Always enjoy your show, so it's a treat to be on. As far as NSA's Cybersecurity Directorate, it is the most recent incarnation of our cyber talent, but by bringing together several organizations that before were not under one common leadership umbrella. And what I mean by that is we brought the keys, codes, and crypto mission that NSA has done forever, where we create the encryption algorithms used for the classified networks, the war fighting systems, all of the national security systems is what that's referred to in the US. So we've always done that keys, codes, and crypto mission. We've had a smattering of other capabilities, both connected to that and disconnected to that, where we looked at foreign threat actors, where we had the red, blue, and hunt teams, and a pile of other technical expertise that was responsible for information assurance and cybersecurity. We brought all that together, but most importantly, we now weave through it a common thread of threat intelligence. And really, that is NSA's strategic advantage, is we can look into foreign space and understand what threat actors are doing, especially those nation-state high-end threat actors. And we can then use that to inform how we use our resources, how we advise others to secure their systems, and then produce the technical guidance that hopefully helps with that defense. So it's really a wealth of critical no-fail missions on behalf of our nation, which is the defense of those national security systems, working to defend the DoD, and then the defense industrial base. So the companies that are out there producing weapon systems and warfighting capabilities.
So I guess what you've already said might clear up, I guess, some of the misconceptions, because it did seem like, oh, look at this, you know, NSA Cybersecurity Directorate spinning out advice that's kind of useful in all sorts of places. But it seems like what you're saying is the actual mission is a little bit more focused, perhaps, than CSIS, for example.
It is. So we are we're responsible for, like I said, the national security systems, but also that we're the sector-specific agency, the Department of Defense is, for protecting the defense industrial base. And CISA has a much wider remit. They do all the unclassified.gov. They do big portions of critical infrastructure. There's a few, you know, everybody learned during the Colonial Pipeline attack that, hey, Department of Transportation is the sector-specific agency for cybersecurity of pipelines, right? Mm. Most people probably didn't recognize that, right? So there's sector-specific agencies, and then there's broad capabilities. CISA can go in and support those agencies and has a much wider remit in that arena. But I think the big thing NSA focuses on is bringing that technical expertise. The way we often phrase it is, you know, it takes a thief to catch a thief. And I've been on both sides of our mission, you know, leading what was formerly tailored access operations, the computer network operations activities at NSA. And it instills in you a mindset of how attackers work in the practical environment, how they would compromise a highly defended network. And those kind of insights really change the way you inform defensive guidance and defensive advice. And we try to leverage that into the mission every day. Team is comprised of people who have been back and forth across that membrane several times across their career. And it's a huge advantage.
Well, your big sort of debut in the InfoSec, in the sort of civilian InfoSec world, was that talk you did about how to make my life hard as a TAO guy, right? And it was a fantastic talk. That's I can think of only a handful of talks that really got talked about as much, right? And that was one of them. So it is interesting now having someone from an offensive background in a, you know, running a defensive agency. It's certainly an edge, I think, but I'm biased towards thinking offensive. People with offensive skills have an edge.
Yeah, so it definitely is an important capability. It's not the only thing, but NSA has deep technical roots, and we tap those. I think it shows in the type of advice we give, the releases we've been doing, the cybersecurity advisories. But I'd also really point out that most of those come out dual seal, tri-seal, or even more, right? We work those with our CISA partners, often with our FBI partners, sometimes even with the Five Eyes peers.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? If you've got a campaign targeting the defense industrial base, I mean, quite often those adversary TTPs are going to be recycled across a wider target set. So that information is going to be useful to people outside of just the people you're sort of tasked with protecting.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And the interesting thing is they are practical honeypots, right? Though you can change your infrastructure, you can change your tools, but in the end, you're probably coming at the same targets. So if we're working with those defense industrial base companies, we're leveraging the sensors of the DoD networks, we're going to see things and we're going to understand the types of threats that are out there. And those threats will be coming at other civilian agencies, they'll be coming at places in the commercial industry and even academia at times doing the research.
Well, and this is, I mean, in essence, you've just explained why it's now possible for a senior NSA executive to come and speak on a, you know, cybersecurity podcast about this stuff, because it's not just targeting classified systems anymore, right? Like the targeting that DoD gets is going to look a lot like the attacks against all sorts of civilian and non-classified systems. I mean, that's just one of the things that's changed, isn't it?
Exactly. As well as the technology, you know, it used to be that the government would build these one-off communications devices that were, you know, mil-spec standard and unique. And these days, it is a whole bunch of commercial communications equipment that if you operate, configure, and defend, you will be doing that same thing in the Department of Defense or over at the biggest Fortune 500 companies.
Now, there was a flurry of news articles just recently about the NSA, about your part of NSA spinning up something called the Cyber Collaboration Center. What is it and what's it for?
So it's a location outside our fence line, which is important because that fence line, while it keeps people away from the secrets of NSA, it keeps partners away from good, honest collaboration. So like all good ideas, we tried to launch a collaboration center in December during the pandemic. collaboration in the middle of the pandemic is a little difficult, but we stood it up in a lot of virtual engagements. But it's meant to reach out to the defense industrial base and the service providers that underpin them and start conversations on cybersecurity. So everybody has their favorite threat feed. There are tons of places where people toss indicators of compromise and bad domain names over the fence, and people are inundated with that. What we wanted to do was start interactions with analysts, because a lot of these companies have dedicated teams set up for their defense, have those conversations at a very detailed level about the things we knew and the things we saw. And I would say, you know, the GRU password spraying advisory we just put out is an example, right? Mm. If we set out and just told people, hey, here's a couple of IP addresses that are doing password spraying, it is not of significant interest. But if I can tell a defense company that the GRU is behind this infrastructure doing password spraying, and once they achieve access to an account, they're going to look to elevate privileges and dig in deep with very advanced and stealthy techniques, they'll pay attention, and it's actually very beneficial for them to act on those leads. So what we found is we've got a group of companies who it is all cooperative, right? There's no incentive other than them defending themselves or seeing a value to their business of engaging with us. But they are investing their analysts, their lead, their time to engage on these stories where we pull the thread on a specific type of threat. And
So you're actually hosting staff from these companies within that center, and they're all, because I can think of other efforts that have taken place historically here. I think there was one for banking here with the feds. I can't remember. It was a long time ago, but I think the idea was each of the major banks had someone sort of all in the same building, and that was,
just the idea about the FSARC. Yes. So in our spaces today, we have visits. We have an ongoing daily collaboration virtually. In a bunch of chat channels and data sharing feeds. The intent is to continue to advance that to through one workshops where we pick a specific topic or a specific threat actor, and we dive deep with their resources and ours. And then we've had folks express interest in permanently deploying people to sit with us and continue that interaction on a daily basis. And I think GCHQ's Industry 100 is a good example of that.
So is this something that you could see being broadened out beyond the defense industrial base? I mean, it sounds like that probably isn't really within the scope of what you're supposed to be doing.
Well, there's two key areas. One, CISA participates in some of these exchanges and interactions, right? And so that brings a broader scope to it. But the other is, we are also working with the providers, the internet service providers and capability providers to that defense industrial base, because if your upstream provider is hacked, or if they're able to provide a layer of defense around the companies, you're much more involved in those threats.
Yeah.
So you know, ISPs and cloud providers and others are specific entities that we're engaging with, and they are high leverage activities, right? Because if we teach them about a tradecraft, if we teach them about a technique we're using that reveals some TTPs, then it scales much broader and has much bigger impact.
Well, and it's an interesting thing, right? Because previously, wider outreach, right, and attempts to do this sort of thing at a wider level they kind of stumble, right? I just heard an anecdote the other day, and I can't tell you if it's true or not, right? I'm just telling you, I heard an anecdote that here in Australia, some companies have been impacted by this Kaseya ransomware Reval thing, and they're not telling ACSC because of customer NDAs, right? Now, whether or not that's true or not, it's kind of beside the point. The point is it could be true, and that sort of thing happens quite often. So I guess my question in all of this is, do you foresee a time when broader cooperation between government agencies and industry is going to be possible, and we can maybe let go of some of that way of thinking about, you know, NDAs and, oh no, don't let the government see what's going on because then they might fine us, or, you know, it'll be disclosed or whatever? Can you see that working broadly, or do you think the fact that this has a shot at success is because it's tightly focused?
I think there are cases where it will succeed, and there's cases where it'll be challenged. And let me expand on that, right? There are absolutely companies that will never engage with NSA just because we are a foreign intelligence agency on the other half of the mission. But there's still, you know, like I said, there's a host of companies that are really making a difference who are willing to engage. At the same time, CISA has some deep and really excellent relationships with some companies that are, they're going to go through their door first. And we will see other cases where, you know, they may choose to go the law enforcement route. So it's really important that we all on the U.S. government side are well lashed together and then play in position, make sure that we're working with the widest array and most diverse set of folks. And we've seen that where people will bring things to us at NSA where they haven't gone to others in the community. And we're able to then start the conversation, pursue the analysis, and share that back into the bigger set, and have a couple examples now where that brought both tradecraft and indicators to light that commercial industry had a little bit of understanding, that the Defense Department had some, NSA could see in the foreign space. And when you knit that together, that tapestry paints a much more robust picture. And then the interaction, again, I go back to that. It is not throwing an indicator over the fence. It's telling stories and doing collaborative joint analysis, often leveraging classified SIGINT that is brought down to that unclassified level that is the power of this partnership.
Now, the conversation so far, I mean, it's sort of set up something interesting, I think, because you're clearly very, very focused as a foreign intelligence agency, right? You're very focused on what adversaries are trying to do to certain computers in the United States, right? They're trying to do collection against defense industrial base targets, against government systems, things like that. That's what you're chartered with protecting. But there's this whole conversation going on right now, as I'm sure you're aware, that ransomware is perhaps something that should be elevated to the status of being a national security issue. But because this stuff isn't being, you know, these crimes are not being perpetrated by foreign state actors, it is kind of outside of the remit of NSA, right? So I guess I'm just asking you what, I want to ask you what your feelings are about how we should think about ransomware from your perspective, from the perspective of a security agency that's trying to protect the United States from foreign adversaries. You know, when we're dealing with this new class of attacker, which isn't actually a foreign state adversary, but is causing damage to US interests, like, how do you go about reconciling all of that, right?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any ambiguity today that ransomware is a national security threat. And so NSA as the national security agency has a role in that. I think the debate right now is how much of this needs to move to the front of the priority queue, because in any area, there's finite resources to be spread around. And if you're applying them to criminal threats, you're taking away something from the advanced persistent threat nation state actors. But in the end, it is clear that there is an element of this criminal activity that is in safe havens that we need to address. And I think NSA will play a role in a couple dimensions of that. One is that foreign intelligence work we do will inform the policymakers and the diplomats as to how we can pursue those safe havens. And then over in the technical support that NSA provides across the various elements, whether it's law enforcement or the protection of critical infrastructure or the support we provide to the action arms of the U.S. government, you know, we're going to inform in that space as well. So I think overall, we've got to impose cost on malicious cyber actors behind the ransomware attacks.
Now, that line that you just used, we've got to impose costs, right? It has, and I say this with total respect, that line is kind of the government SIGINT agency equivalent of we take your security very seriously, because we hear a lot of talk about imposing costs, but then no one actually sort of talks about what those costs might be. Now, I know that I can't really ask you to comment on policy, right? Policy is not something that you set when it comes to this stuff, and this stuff is White House level these days, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing I wanted to get your opinion on, right? Because you as you mentioned earlier, you used to run TAO, right? You're a senior executive at NSA. You've had some very interesting experience throughout your career. As you know, we've been advocating on this show for a long time for more offensive actions to be taken against ransomware crews by non-law enforcement agencies. I know you can't, well, I think it's unlikely that you can comment on whether or not you think that should happen, but I would be curious to know if you think it would be effective to do that, because I can't think of too many other people who would have insight there. So is that something that you're able to share your thoughts on?
I think if you look at the ways we have leverage, there's a number of ways we have leverage. There are people behind these actions. There's infrastructure. There's tools. There's finances that make this successful. And then there's the safe havens. And I think in each and every one of those, you can come up with scenarios where you can do that work across all the elements the U.S. government has to impose costs. And so it is a matter of policy and partnerships to think about, you know, what you would do across that. But we stand ready to support those decision makers who have to feed the policy decisions.
Yeah.
And then we don't have those Title 10 action authorities, but we are a combat support agency who would support DOD and the other elements. We would support FBI and all the tools they have, Treasury, State Department, and even, you know, the things we do out into commercial businesses, where those partnerships, they're able to often be very impactful in collaborative and cooperative ways, if you can enable them as well.
I mean, it's interesting because the way that you answered that question is you just described, you know, ransomware not so much as being a very simple little thing. It's more of an ecosystem with a number of different vulnerable points, right? It's always struck me as kind of insane that you know, a great deal of this activity is being coordinated on really rickety PHP forums, right? Like, that just seems like, I can hear you laughing, right? Yeah, but do you see what I mean? Like, it just seems like you're probably never going to eliminate this stuff by popping shells, but it must be a situation where someone such as yourself would be sitting there going, oh, we could do something here.
It's just the case that it is always going to be an evolution across this, right? We take actions, others will have reactions and solutions to those. And so you're going to have to continue. And that's where we go back to that well-worn line of impose costs, because what you've got to do is convince some people to get out of the game and others not to get in it.
It's also what you were saying before about resource constraints, right? Because it's not like you can just throw a few people at this for a week and it's done. It needs to be something that is rolling and continuing, and that takes time and money and resources, and, you know, other things might suffer as a result of that.
Yep. But I think you see the White House really serious about the threats when they take away our gasoline and hamburgers, right? You're messing with the US.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and one after the other too. That was crazy. And it was, I don't know if you heard my interview with Tim Watts, but he was talking about how ransomware until Colonial wasn't a barbecue stopper. And then, yeah, a week later, the world's biggest meatworks gets ransomware, and that is definitely a barbecue stopper. So look, I want to just talk a little bit more broadly about the threat landscape right now and the situation we find ourselves in. because it feels a bit grim. You know, for a long time doing this show, you know, it felt like things were steadily, incrementally getting better for a while. It sort of feels like we've slid backwards a little bit. People are being owned by bugs in products that just shouldn't be there. It just feels like we're having a bit of a hard time at the moment, almost like it's a bit of a crisis. What's your feeling with regard to where we are, the general state of cybersecurity out there? Because my feeling is pretty pessimistic at the moment, I've got to be honest.
Yeah, I wouldn't echo, you know, your words, but I do think we hit an inflection point. I just kind of reflect on the last couple of years and the threat landscape is rising. The scope and scale of many of the exploits out there are really significant. It's to the point that it's clear that doing the same thing we did last year is not going to slow that curve. And so that's why, you know, NSA took the steps about 20 months ago to form the cybersecurity directorate, right? We've got to work differently. And we said, what is the thing that will enable us at scale to work differently? And that is infusing threat information across all of the missions, using our reach to drive the strategies we're going to pursue. It was the driver behind opening the Cybersecurity Collaboration Center that, you know, we're not going to solve all of this in government spaces, and we're not going to just using foreign intelligence have the insights that the community needs. And so taking our insights and injecting those into the expert analysts in the commercial space, we enable them to act in their sphere. So it's these kind of things where we've got to do things differently.
Now, I understand that. And that sounds like all very reasonable stuff, which is trying to actually take intelligence and make it actionable, you know, in places that previously weren't benefiting from necessarily that you know, that intelligence analysis, right? But then we've got this crazy situation where, you know, in the aftermath of the SolarWinds campaign, which is what it's referred to often, you know, even though it was a little bit broader than that, we got this crazy situation where some US agencies and departments don't really know how badly they were affected and can't really trace the origins of the intrusion into their networks because Microsoft treats logging as a premium feature. So, you know, and this is happening while a whole bunch of organizations are getting owned through a auth bypass in the front end web interface of a remote management tool, this being the Kaseya stuff. I feel like vendors need maybe a kick in the ass at the moment, Rob, and I'm just wondering what your feelings are on that. And, you know, what sort of levers can you pull from your position to maybe try to get vendors to do stuff like offer basic features at reasonable prices instead of treating them like, you know, cash cows? And maybe testing their products to shake out some of the really stupid bugs that we've seen in things like PulseSecure, F5, Kaseya, whatnot. Like, do you agree that we have a problem with vendors doing silly things? And part two, what can you do about it?
I agree that there's a lot of flaws and bugs in commercial products that we need to help eliminate. And there's a series of ways that I think will play a specific role. You've seen us do some vulnerability research and then roll out disclosures to a number of companies to help them improve the security of their products.
But shouldn't they be doing that? That's my question, right? Like it almost feels like it's just crazy that some of the bugs that you're seeing that are causing havoc out there, they shouldn't be there. These are companies that make money hand over fist, and they can't throw 50 grand at a competent tester to find this stuff. Like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Yeah. I agree that, you know, the ideas of bug bounties and pen tests are exceptionally valuable, and we encourage those things, right? We encourage companies to use that, the suite of tools these days to find poor software development practices and to make sure that, you know, you have memory safe conditions and can lock out whole classes of bugs are available. And so, you know, we've got the opportunity in the Department of Defense to start driving that ecosystem with our contracting and how we require and request security in those capabilities. So,
and this is the thing that I was getting at, is the procurement lever is a big one for the US government, right? And everybody gets the benefit of that because no one wants to get locked out of US government contracts, right? So there's a CISA component of that for the civilian agencies. And then there's the defense side, which is more But do you think we're actually going to see the US government maybe start to pull some of those levers, like saying, hey, if you want to sell to us, you need, say, an assessment strategy for your product where every 6 months you're actually getting it tested when you ship new features, things like that. I mean, because there's so much that could be done there. Do you think that's something that's on the cards?
Yeah. So those are ideas that we're talking about. It's not just NSA in the driver's seat there, right? There are big partners in, certainly in the DoD acquisition side, and some of the big federal acquisition regulation, but we recognize that is a powerful tool akin to the tools that others have in regulation. And, you know, it's clear that we've got to balance the scales a little bit back off the market driving and just pick some components that we need to focus on.
But I mean, it is almost a market failure, isn't it? When you've got, I mean, I'm thinking, look, we don't even know necessarily 100% the details of this Kaseya thing, but the fact that it looks like it was a bug in an, you know, in a front end web interface, it really just does make you slap your head and just think, you know, what on earth? What do you think could be some effective steps that vendors should take in terms of their policies to better address these sorts of issues that we've been seeing causing all sorts of drama lately? What are, you know, should it be regular pen tests of their products? Should those pen tests go to some sort of firm that has some level of certification? Like, how do you ensure that the testing that they're doing to tick the box is of a certain level of assured quality? Like, how would you go about addressing this, I guess is my question.
I think those are all fine ideas, Patrick. I also think, you know, as I mentioned, the setting the bar for new software developments to make sure you're using modern tools and modern practices to shake things out in the development cycle is also important. I look back, it's, you know, it's a well-worn analogy, but I've become a firm believer. You know, we wouldn't have things like anti-lock brakes, airbags and the kind of gas mileage we do today without some government intervention. And you know, it's to the point that, you know, Rob's personal opinion is we've got to tighten in that space and start driving a few of the baseline requirements. And you're seeing the Department of Defense focused on that, at least in our acquisition space.
Yeah, I think, you know, wider civilian agency acquisition, that's where it really has a big impact on the wider ecosystem, though, isn't it? Because the US government writ large is such a huge customer.
Don't underestimate how much the Department of Defense spends on IT, though.
Oh, no, I know. I just know that you're not buying necessarily as diverse a suite of products as the rest of the government. That's more what I meant, right? Like, there's probably fewer vendors, but yeah, massive spends. Now, look, you kind of didn't really take the bait on my on my Microsoft question. So I'm just going to ask you straight up. Do you think the way Microsoft is handling its licensing tiers is problematic?
Well, let me go this way, which is in these recent events, what Microsoft has done is, even though some people didn't have access to the logs, they put their teams on analyzing these logs, these capabilities, and were able to tell people, using their own analysts and their deep expertise in the products, that they had a problem. So that is a win. But ideally, you know, the way we have talked about it is, the way you defend a network is you have to know your network to defend your network. Part of knowing your network is having logs, enabling those logs, and having a team that actually invests in understanding what's normal and what's not normal to find the anomalies. So the concept of getting access to that information and utilizing it, yeah, that's something you've got to do to defend a network.
Sure, sure. But I guess what I'm asking is whether or not their current approach to giving people that capability is problematic. And I understand if you don't want to comment, but if you don't want to comment...
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that.
Don't comment. Yeah, okay. No, fair enough. Now, look, another thing that I just wanted to cover off with you, right? I had this really interesting chat with a researcher in the Netherlands named Dirk-Jan Malema about 0365 and Azure AD security. And the thing that I took away from that, which was a bit of a depressing realization, is that in the early days of like cloud adoption, it felt like because the platforms didn't offer crazy broad functionality, it seemed like we were getting some gains in security as people made these cloud migrations. Now that the migration to the cloud has sped up, we're just seeing the cloud platforms add more and more features, and it feels like they're maybe repeating some of the mistakes that we made previously in the previous generation of computing systems. So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are with regard to, you know, how the great cloud migration of the 2020s is going. Do you think we are getting rid of our old technical debt and just taking on new technical debt? Because that's my fear there.
Yeah, it is clear that there is a level of complexity that's beyond the abilities of some of the users to configure and secure it. And it's changing the models of, you know, how you instrument and detect anomalous behavior. I am a firm believer that by moving to a cloud environment and doing it right, you are in a much more secure configuration. But that's only if you do it right. And so I think that's a role we at NSA will play, is providing the guidance, the things you need to both turn on and turn off. And those aren't necessarily the default settings when you just spin up a brand new instance.
But shouldn't that be up to the cloud platforms to kind of provide their customers with more secure by default configs? Like, surely, and this is what I mean about repeating mistakes. This is like shipping NT4 servers with everything turned on. It's nuts.
Yeah. And I do think that some of the engagements, again, that cybersecurity collaboration center is the kind of environment we are having those dialogues with the companies. And I think on the whole, most of them are very interested in when we can show them new and novel ways that we could exploit those services and the ways to reconfigure them into a much more safe and secure manner.
Oh man, that's interesting. So you, former head of TAO, is doing show and tell sessions for the cloud platforms and scaring them. That'd be fun.
Yes. So we're having, that is the kind of engagements that are going on in those collaboration channels. So that is where that expertise is being applied. And it's
really
beneficial.
Do you have to use hand puppets, or do they follow?
No. These companies, they understand their products. They develop and they have amazing deep experts. But at times, you know, we will understand the nuances of an edge case of a feature to an extent they hadn't considered. And, you know, it's interesting watching the eye-opening realization across their face. But when you get two tech geeks together to talk about that thing, you know, I hear it in Adam's voice when he talks about the news and admires a good hack. You know, that's the kind of conversations that are going on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the issues, though, is when you've shipped all of these insecure defaults, people wind up configuring things so that they need those settings to be where they are. You start trying to tighten them up later and they break, right?
Yeah.
So that's why that was my comment about technical debt. But it seems we've got a bit of a recurring theme here, which is the market not testing its products and shipping default configs that are insane, right? So, I mean, I understand that you can't regulate your way out of this. The government can't just come in and say, no, you need to do it this way. And that the only real lever available to the US government is to build in procurement rules to try to mop some of this up. But I don't know. I mean, do you feel like the market, the IT market, right? Because we're not even just talking about security vendors here. Do you feel like it is sort of failing us a little bit at the moment? Because I do. I sort of feel like they've forgotten the lessons of 20 years ago, you know, and they're just doing all the dumb stuff again.
I wouldn't put everybody in that boat, but there certainly are examples.
God, you're diplomatic.
I'm trying, Patrick. I was stationed at the embassy in London in the last posting.
That's right. You moved to London as a liaison, and then there was a pandemic, so you wound up moving to London to do Zoom calls.
In one sense, yes. I had eight good months of getting out and about with the partners, and then we did a lot of virtual engagement, much as the commercial sector did. So went all of ours.
Now, of course, you were the person who sat through a million meetings so that Ghidra could be open sourced out of NSA, and a lot of people would thank you for that. I assume that's going well.
We think it really is. The open source community has jumped in. People are offering improvements. They're building on it. But most importantly, they're finding bugs. And they're challenging us with new use cases. So we just put out version 10 of Ghidra and new features. The biggest thing is a debugger. We put in an exporter, some more grafting and scripting capabilities. But it continues to improve and evolve. And I think it's just a really excellent example of taking some government technology and moving it out where smart people can challenge it and improve it.
And now you get to experience the joy of being an open source maintainer where you give people something for free and then they scream at you.
Yeah, most of it is happy feedback. I won't say it is all perfect, but it's really impressive how people have adopted it and are using it in ways that I certainly didn't consider. Watching commercial gaming platforms reversed a bit so they can run new and old software, homebrew stuff, and just it's just impressive how much technical talent's out there and gets applied.
Yeah, when you give them the tools. I mean, the reason I mentioned that is because you were talking about spinning out some guidance out of NSA, you know, with regard to some of this cloud stuff, and you know, assisting the cloud companies in providing more default secure configs. Can we expect to see more technology releases from NSA after the success of Ghidra? Because I understand that, you know, doing the first one of them, oh my Lord, you know, I mean, if the impression I get is that it was very hard to get that one over the line. But now that's done, do you think we're going to see more?
Yeah, I don't have the list in front of me, but there's easily a dozen open source products out of NSA and different technologies we've put out there. We have our own GitHub. So if you go out to GitHub and just look, there are a number of software things that have been dropped in. Some are pretty niche. Some haven't, you know, were never intended to have the big impact that Ghidra does. But we're going to continue to push tools into that arena.
And is that stuff where you're going to be developing tools to release? Or is it more a case of, well, we got this useful thing here, we might spin it out? Or is it both?
It's both. And it goes back all the way to like the SE Linux, the Security Enhanced Linux extensions.
Yep.
We put out, you know, I don't even know how many years ago, to cover down because we wanted to trust Linux and use it in some important national security areas. And we just saw flaws that we couldn't tolerate. And so we spun it out into the commercial version, and that improved the whole ecosystem. And pieces of that survived into like Android source code and continue to live on through that environment.
Excellent. Well, Rob Joyce, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. I mean, it's a real privilege to have you on the show. And, you know, I really want to thank you for being so generous with your time. It was great to chat to you, and all the best with what you're doing over there, because it, you know, it's going to benefit us all. So cheers.
Hey, thanks, Patrick. Really great to be here. And, you know, I think you really captured the heart of our focus today, right? We don't want to be awesome at incident response. We already failed at that point. We're trying to look at the high leverage activities, things we could do in front of those compromises to drive down that risk. And so we're going to have to keep innovating there because the challenges are pretty big.
That was Rob Joyce there with a chat about all sorts of stuff, really. Big thanks to him for making himself available for that interview. And that is it for this edition. I'll be back next week with another Risky Business podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.